Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
This is the Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
In late January 21, Sandra Birchmore texted a friend about Matthew Farwell. He'd come to her apartment the night before. He brought her ginger ale. Her friend texted back, "He's coming around." Sandra believed the man who had been exploiting her since she was 15, possibly younger, was finally softening, finally accepting the pregnancy, finally choosing her, even a little. She imagined a version of a future where Farwell would be part of their child's life, or whatever twisted connection they had built over a decade might become something resembling a family. Within days, Sandra would be dead. The ginger ale wasn't a peace offering. It was the last time she would interpret cruelty as kindness. This is part two of our five-part series on the Sandra Birchmore case. In part one, we told you how Sandra entered the Stoughton Police Explorers program at 12 years old and was groomed and exploited by multiple officers over the span of a decade. Now we're inside the final month of her life. The pregnancy, the escalation, and the warning that should have saved her. To understand the final month of Sandra's life, you have to understand what December 2020 meant for Matthew Farwell. Sandra learned she was pregnant. She told Farwell he was the father, and the walls of his carefully compartmentalized life started caving in. Farwell was already a father of two. His wife was pregnant with their third child. He was a Stoughton police detective, the patrol officer's union president, a former soldier. He had built a public identity that depended entirely on Sandra Birchmore remaining invisible. Her pregnancy made that impossible. According to the superseding federal indictment, the baby Sandra was carrying was a boy, gestational age between 8 and 10 weeks at the time of her death. She was barely into the first trimester, and her whole world was reorganizing around this child. Sandra wasn't treating the pregnancy like a secret. That's important. She wasn't hiding. She wasn't ashamed. She made a poster to celebrate the pregnancy and sent Farwell a photo of it. She told friends, coworkers, and family members that he was the father. She was working as a teacher's assistant at an elementary school in Sharon, spending her days helping other people's children while preparing for one of her own. She was taking nursing courses at Massillot Community College. She was building towards something real. She was doing it openly. Sandra Birchmore, at 23 years old, was not a woman in crisis. She was a woman making plans. And that is precisely what made her dangerous to Matthew Farwell. Because Farwell was making plans too, not the kind that Sandra had imagined. According to witness statements gathered by federal investigators, Farwell made comments in the weeks before Sandra's death that in hindsight read like warnings nobody understood in the time. He told one person that if Sandra didn't end the pregnancy, he would take care of the problem himself. He told another person he needed to put crazy back in the bag. A former coworker told the FBI that about 2 weeks before Sandra died, when he was at a restaurant and mentioned having problems with a woman other than his wife. When a coworker asked if they could help, Farwell said, "The problem was going to take care of itself." Three different people. Three different conversations, all pointing towards a man who saw a pregnant woman not as a human being carrying his child, but as a loose end that needed to be tied off. Sandra was talking to people, and every person she told was another crack in the wall Farwell had built between his public life and the decade of exploitation he'd been hiding. She told friends about her relationship with Farwell. She told coworkers he was the father of her child. But here's the detail that federal prosecutors say reframes the entire motive. Sandra wasn't just confiding in friends. She had contacted lawyers. And according to prosecutors, Sandra was developing a plan to obtain financial support for her child. She was exploring her legal options, and most critically, evidence indicates she was prepared to disclose that Farwell had S abused and exploited her when she was underage. Sandra wasn't just going to name Farwell as the father. She was preparing to disclose the criminal S conduct against her. The years. All of it. It started when she was 15. And she was 20 now. 23. And had, according to prosecutors, become assertive and resistant to his manipulation after learning she was pregnant. She was willing to use her role as a victim of Farwell's crime to ensure that she and her unborn child would be financially secure. For the first time in decades, Sandra was starting to understand her own leverage. She was starting to understand that what happened to her wasn't a relationship, it was a crime. And she was preparing to say so out loud to people with the authority to act on it. For Matthew Farwell, this was not a manageable situation. This was not an uncomfortable conversation or an embarrassing revelation. If Sandra went to lawyers and disclosed all of this, he was looking at criminal charges, an end to his career, the destruction of his marriage and prison. Every thread of his carefully managed life was pulling loose at the same time. The pregnancy was the fuse. Sandra's willingness to talk was the match. And on January 20th, 2021, someone lit it. 11 days before Sandra's death, her friend picked up the phone and called the Stoughton Police Department. She told the department employee that Matthew Farwell was in an inappropriate relationship with her. It was exactly the kind of call that should trigger an internal alarm. An outside person reporting that a detective in the department was involved with a woman he'd known since she was a child in the department's own youth program in any functioning institution. That call goes to internal affairs. It gets documented. It gets investigated. It becomes a file that protects the person being victimized. Not in Stoughton. Nope. It's not how they do things there. That's not what happened. What happened is one of the most damning details in the entire case. The department employee who received the call told Matthew Farwell about it. Went directly to the guy that the complaint's about. The one institution that should have protected Sandra instead hand-delivered the warning to the man federal prosecutors say took her life. They didn't open an investigation. They didn't flag it for a supervisor. They didn't contact Sandra. They told Farwell that someone was talking. And 11 days later, Sandra was dead. Think about the position Sandra was in during those final days and how cruel the contrast is between her reality and her perception. She'd been exploited by Farwell since she was 12. She was carrying a baby that she believed was his. She was contacting lawyers. She was telling the truth to people in her life. And the one time someone who loved her tried to report it to authorities, the authorities gave her abuser the heads up. Every safety net that should have existed for Sandra Birchmore had a hole in it. Every hole led back to the same department that was supposed to protect people like her. The timeline compresses fast after January 20th. Sandra continued going to work at the elementary school in Sharon. She continued texting friends. She was still making plans for the baby. She was texting about baby supplies, thinking about what came next, operating under the belief that Farwell was coming around. The ginger ale visit reinforced that belief. She had no reason to think the walls were closing in because from where she stood, things were looking up. Consider the cruelty of that asymmetry. Sandra was living in a version of reality where things were getting better. She was surrounded by small signs of progress. Farwell was visiting. She was making plans. She had a support system forming around her pregnancy, even if it was fragile. She had no way of knowing that her friends called the Stoughton Police Department. The one act of advocacy that should have triggered her protection had instead been routed directly to the man who posed the greatest danger to her. Sandra was operating without the most critical piece of information in her life, that the system she still believed in had already betrayed her one final time. Farwell saw the situation from the opposite angle. The circle of people who knew about Sandra was expanding every day. A formal complaint had been made to his department, and he knew about it because they told him. Sandra was talking to attorneys. His wife was about to have their third child. Every thread of his carefully managed double life was pulling loose at once. During the 8 years he had been grooming Sandra, according to prosecutors, Farwell engaged in multiple extramarital affairs with other adult women. But he worked much harder to keep his relationship with Sandra a secret than any of the others. She was different. She represented criminal exposure, not just personal embarrassment. And now she was talking. According to prosecutors, he planned what happened next well in advance. Here's a detail from this period that prosecutors included in their filings that speaks to Sandra's state of mind. She had made a request for a key to her apartment from Farwell about a week before she died. According to the FBI, Farwell had a key. He had access to her home. The man who would allegedly kill her could walk in any time he chose. Sandra gave him that access because she still trusted him. Because despite everything, despite the decade of exploitation, despite the fact that he had taken so much from her, despite the fact that he was married with children, Sandra still believed Farwell was part of her life, not a threat to it. That trust was the final thing he exploited. February 1st to 21, surveillance cameras at Sandra's apartment building in Canton, a complex called Windsor Woods, captured her walking in and out of the building during the afternoon. She was wearing the clothes she'd had on all day. She was living an ordinary day, running errands, moving through the world the way you do when you have no idea it's the last time. That evening at 9:27 p.m., the cameras captured someone else entering the building. Matthew Farwell walked into the lobby and stepped onto the elevator. At 9:56 p.m., he walked back out 29 minutes later. When Sandra's body was discovered 3 days later on February 4th, she was wearing the same clothes she wore on February 1st. She had not changed. She had not gone out again. She had not moved from that night. Her colleagues at the elementary school in Sharon had raised the alarm after she missed consecutive days of work. Sandra was reliable. She showed up. When she stopped showing up, the people who worked with her knew something was wrong. Police responded to a wellness check and found her in the apartment she had moved into with Farwell's help, in the building where she had been trying to build an independent life. She was 3 months pregnant with a baby boy she had already started planning for. Sandra Birchmore was never seen alive again after Matthew Farwell walked into her building at 9:27 p.m. on February 1st, 2021. What happened inside the apartment, inside those 29 minutes, is the subject of our next chapter. But what you should carry into that chapter is the knowledge that Sandra spent her final days hopeful. She was planning a life. She was fighting for her child. She was contacting lawyers to secure her future and her baby's future. She believed the man who had controlled her for a decade was finally choosing her. Finally accepting the pregnancy, finally becoming the person she had spent 10 years hoping he would be. She was wrong about that. She was right about everything else. Sandra knew what had been done to her. She was ready to name it, and that, according to federal prosecutors, is why she is dead. In part three, we go inside those 29 minutes. The surveillance footage, the DNA on the murder weapon, the clavicle injury that didn't match the staged one, the broken necklace tangled in Sandra's hair, and the drunken reenactment that may be the most chilling detail in the entire case. Press subscribe so you don't miss it. It's coming up next in our series. If you want to get a full grasp on what this case is about, what happened from start to finish, this five-part series reporting out this week is the best place to do that. So press subscribe and don't miss it. We're putting them all out for you this week. And hopefully you can get a better understanding as we get closer to the trial. Give us your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. Links are in the description. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
February 1st of 2021, surveillance cameras at the Windsor Woods apartment complex in Canton, Massachusetts, recorded Sandra Birchmore moving in and out of the building during the afternoon. She's in the clothes she's been wearing all day. At 9:27 p.m., a man enters the building lobby and gets on the elevator. It's Matthew Farwell, former Stoughton Police extraordinaire detective, patrol officers union president, the man who, according to federal prosecutors, had been ass-exploiting Sandra since she was 15 years old. Known her since she was 12 in the Police Explorers program. At 9:56 p.m., he leaves, 29 minutes. When Sandra's body is found 3 days later, she's wearing the same clothes. She never changed. She never left the apartment. Federal prosecutors allege that inside those 29 minutes, Matthew Farwell strangled Sandra Birchmore and her unborn son, then staged the scene to make it look like she had taken her own life. This is what the evidence tells us about that night. This is part three of our five-part series on the Sandra Birchmore case. In parts one and two, if you've not watched them, I highly recommend going back and starting there. We covered how Sandra was groomed by officers in a police youth program, the pregnancy that made her an existential threat to Matthew Farwell, and the final days leading up to this night. Now we're inside the evidence itself. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we work our way through it, and please do press subscribe wherever you're listening. Sandra's colleagues at Sharon Public Schools raised the alarm. She'd missed multiple days of work, which was not like her. She was reliable. She showed up. When she didn't, people noticed quickly. Police responded to a wellness check at her Canton apartment on February 4th of 2021. What they found was Sandra on her bedroom floor in a seated position with a ligature tied around her neck. The ligature was fastened to the closet door handle. First responders believe she'd been gone for days. The scene looked at first glance like a low-hanging suspension, the kind of scene that gets filed under a specific category quickly if nobody's looking too hard. Canton police initially described the ligature as a scarf. It wasn't a scarf. Canton police lied. It was a duffel bag strap. Somehow, they thought, oh, it's a scarf. That sounds like something a woman might use to do this with. It was a duffel bag strap. And if you're too stupid to understand the difference between a scarf and a duffel bag strap, I'm sorry, there's no real hope for you. But if you're trying to cover something up and get something on paper that's not really what it is, well, they succeeded at that for long enough because everybody in the Canton Police Department seems to like to cover up for everybody else, in my opinion. That misidentification would become one of the most significant investigative failures in the case. And let's call it for what it is, intentional investigative failure, a lie. But the thread belongs in the next chapter. This chapter stays inside the evidence of what actually happened on the night of February 1st. Let's start with the DNA. For years, that strap sat in evidence without anyone comparing it against the DNA of the man who was last seen entering Sandra's building. Why? Well, again, we go back to Stoughton police. They don't like telling on each other. They're not like even seeing if each other is up to horrible shit, because I'm going to guess a lot of them are, in my opinion. And if you start looking in someone else's closet, they might start looking in your closet. You don't want that. So everybody just kind of keeps their closet separate from each other. Don't ask, don't tell in a real sick way. State investigators never obtained a DNA sample from Matthew Farwell. They never tested the strap against anyone because they didn't want to know. Whoever had the choice to get that answer didn't want it to be found out. After Farwell's arrest in August of 2024, the FBI finally obtained his DNA. What they found was devastating for his defense. Farwell's DNA was on the ligature. The duffel bag strap that was lied about as being a scarf that was tied around Sandra's neck and connected to the closet door handle had Matthew Farwell's genetic material on it. Prosecutors described the presence of his DNA on the murder weapon as highly inculpatory. His genetic material, to put it nicely for YouTube, swimmers were also found in the underwear Sandra was wearing at the time of her death. So he went in for one last time and then took her life. Jesus Christ. Farwell had told state police investigators in 2021 that he hadn't been intimate with Sandra in months, claiming the last time was in October of 2020. The physical evidence says he was lying. His DNA was there because he was there. The forensic record contradicts every claim he made about his last contact with her. Now, layering the physical evidence of a struggle, this is where the stage scene starts to fall apart. Sandra's right clavicle showed an injury that occurred while she was still alive, not post-mortem, not during decomposition. While she was living and breathing, according to prosecutors, that clavicle injury matched the buckle of a knot found behind her head. Think about what that means. The strap was around her neck, tied to the doorknob with a buckle at the knot behind her head. The matching injury on her chest means a buckle struck her there while she was alive before she ended up in the position in which she was found. Prosecutors say this proves Sandra could not have died the way the scene was arranged. The injury pattern contradicts the staging. It tells the story of a physical confrontation, not a quiet death. And then there's the flamingo necklace. Sandra regularly wore a pink flamingo pendant on a chain around her neck. When her body was found, the necklace wasn't on her. Weeks later, a relative returned to the apartment and found the broken necklace on the bedroom floor, tangled with a clump of Sandra's hair. A relative finds, just because there's no investigation. The relative turned it over to investigators. A necklace doesn't snap off someone's neck and pull out their hair during a quiet, staged death. It breaks during a violent struggle. Someone grabbing, pulling, fighting. That necklace sat on that floor for weeks because the initial investigation didn't find it. They weren't looking hard enough to notice a broken piece of jewelry tangled in hair on the bedroom floor of a dead woman's apartment. Good job, Stoughton PD. There's one more forensic detail that should have redirected the investigation from day one. Sandra's cell phone recorded its final movements while Farwell was still inside her apartment. The phone data shows activity that correlates with the time window in which Farwell was present. If anyone had pulled that data in the immediate aftermath of Sandra's death, they would have known exactly who was in that apartment when Sandra's phone stopped registering movement. Nobody pulled the data. Not Canton police, not the state police troopers assigned to the case, not the medical examiner's office. The FBI pulled it later during the federal investigation and found what should have been obvious to anyone who was looking. Farwell was there when Sandra died. The phone knew. The investigators chose not to ask. The phone data, combined with the surveillance footage, creates a timeline that prosecutors say is damning. Farwell enters at 9:27. Sandra's phone records its last movements while he is inside. Farwell leaves at 9:56. Sandra is never seen alive again. The window is narrow, the evidence is specific, and the conclusion prosecutors draw is that Farwell came to that apartment with a plan and executed it within half an hour. Federal prosecutors allege Farwell killed Sandra with malice, aforethought, willfully, deliberately, maliciously, and with premeditation to prevent her from communicating information to law enforcement about the federal crimes he had committed against her. Those crimes included criminal S conduct against a minor that began when she was 15 and continued S exploitation throughout her adult years, including while he was on duty. Prosecutors say he planned the killing well in advance. He didn't snap. He didn't act in a moment of panic or rage. He went to that apartment on February 1st, 2021 with a purpose. He was there for 29 minutes, took advantage of her, and then took her life. And when he walked out at 9:56 p.m., Sandra and her unborn son were dead. What Farwell did after that night tells you as much about the man as what prosecutors say he did inside the apartment. He told one witness he had to put crazy back in the bag, using language that reduced Sandra to a problem he'd managed. He joked about her death, according to a witness who later spoke with FBI agents. And then there's the reenactment. At a small private gathering sometime after Sandra's death, an inebriated Matthew Farwell demonstrated how Sandra had supposedly died. He sat down beneath a doorknob and showed the people around him the position her body was found in, acting out the mechanics of a low-hanging suspension, allegedly. He explained that it was possible for someone to die that way. The people in the room watched the man callously perform the death of a woman he allegedly killed. Here's why the reenactment matters so much. The specific position Farwell demonstrated and the details he described about how Sandra was found have not been publicly revealed at the time, or had not at the time. Nobody outside the investigation and the first responder team knew how Sandra's body was positioned. The information wasn't in media reports. It wasn't in public filings. It wasn't available to anyone who wasn't in that apartment on February 4th, or the body was discovered, or who was involved in the investigation. Farwell knew, because prosecutors allege he arranged the body that way. He staged the scene and then he performed it for entertainment while he was drunk. It's not just evidence of knowledge he shouldn't have had. It's a window into how he viewed what he did, not as a trauma, not as a crisis of conscience, as something he could act out at a party. Consider the mechanics of the staging itself, because it tells you something about the person who allegedly did it. According to prosecutors, Farwell staged Sandra, then arranged her body in a seated position on the bedroom floor. He tied the duffel bag strap around her neck and fastened it to the closet door handle. He positioned the scene to look like a low suspension hanging, the kind that investigators sometimes encounter and that can be misread as self-inflicted if no one looks too carefully, because it's nearly impossible to pull off. This wasn't a panicked cover-up. It was calculated. Farwell was a police detective. He knew how crime scenes are processed. He knew what investigators look for, and more importantly, what they tend not to question when the initial narrative feels clean enough. He used that knowledge. He built a scene designed to survive a surface-level review, and for years, that is exactly what he got. After leaving Sandra's apartment, Farwell went on with his life. He went home to his family. His wife gave birth to their third child around the same time investigators were finding Sandra's body. He continued living in the same town, in the same house, for more than 3 years. He didn't flee. He didn't relocate. His defense team later pointed to that as evidence he wasn't a flight risk. Prosecutors offered a different interpretation. Farwell stayed because he had no reason to run. He believed with good reason that no one was going to be coming from him. The local investigation had classified Sandra's death exactly the way he had staged it. He had gotten away with it. Why would he leave? Now the detail that complicates the narrative without weakening it. In June of 2025, DNA testing confirmed that Farwell was not the biological father of Sandra's unborn son. The father has not been publicly identified. Farwell's defense has pointed to that finding as significant, and they're right that it adds complexity. The prosecutors say the motive remains exactly what it's always been. Both Sandra and Farwell believed he was the father. Sandra told everyone in her life. She was contacting lawyers to pursue child support from Farwell specifically. She was prepared to disclose a criminal S conduct against a minor and ongoing exploitation. The threat to Farwell's career, marriage, and freedom was identical, whether the DNA matched or not. He acted in what he believed, and prosecutors say that belief is what drove him to take her life. But the paternity finding also revealed something else. Farwell was not the only male DNA profile allegedly found in Sandra's clothing. Multiple profiles are present. Sandra appears to have been exploited by more than one person in the time leading up to her death. The paternity question doesn't create reasonable doubt about who took her life. It deepens the horror of what her life looked like by the time she was 23. A woman carrying a child, uncertain who the father was because the number of men who had exploited her was that extensive. The exploitation didn't end when Sandra turned 18. It didn't end when she left the Explorers program. It continued in different forms with different men until the night someone ended it permanently. Every piece of physical evidence recovered during the federal investigation pointed to homicide. Farwell's DNA on the murder weapon, his stuff contradicting his own statements, a clavicle injury that didn't match the staged scene, a broken necklace ripped from her neck with her hair still tangled in it, phone data placing Farwell inside the apartment when Sandra stopped moving. And yet for years, Sandra's death was classified as something she did to herself. The state medical examiner ruled it self-inflicted death. The Norfolk County DA's office found no evidence of foul play. The case was closed before it was ever really opened. How that happened and who allowed it to happen is the subject of the next chapter. In part four, we break down the investigation that looked the other way. The one-hour determination of no foul play. The phone they never checked, the DNA they never collected, and the family who refused to accept it. Your thoughts in the comment section and Substack and YouTube as we get to that. As we continue to break down this entire case from start to finish, I'd love for you to weigh in. We'll continue our conversation there in the comment section. Links are in the description. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening or watching right now as well. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.